Good morning. I'd like to call this joint meeting of the House and Senate Judiciary Committees to order. Today is Tuesday, March 14th, 2006. It's now 8:40 a.m. And on the Senate side, I have Senator Terrio, Senator Huggins, Senator French, myself, Senator Seekins, and Representative Coghill. Maybe you'd introduce the members.
On the House side, we have Representative Peggy Wilson and Representative Guerra and myself. I have three members out of town, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And so we're going to start this morning with a presentation to the joint committees on the therapeutic courts. And we have with us to do the initial introductions Janet McCabe, who's the chair of Partners for Progress. Janet, if you'd come up and take the seat of honor for us.
Briefly.
And if you will introduce yourself for the record, and then you will, I understand, introduce our guest speakers today.
Yes, and good morning, Chairman Seekins and Acting House Chair Coghill, and members of the House and Senate Judiciary Committees. For the record, I am Janet McCabe, Chair of Partners for Progress, and thank you very much for this opportunity and showing up on this particularly cold morning. We're delighted that you are willing to come and hear our presentation. Our two guests came from Juneau to provide training for the Juneau Therapeutic Court, headed by Judge Levy. We are also responding to an invitation from House Judiciary Chair Liesl McGuire. Her invitation was extended more than 9 months ago, so I don't think she planned to be absent. This joint session is timely because Representative Roekberg, working with the Department of Law, has introduced House Bill 441 to put all therapeutic courts for repeat addicted offenders under a consistent single system. This helps address the fact that Alaska has twice the number of DUI deaths as other states. So to introduce our guests, Helen Harberts is a special assistant district attorney for problem-solving courts in California. She worked in law enforcement as chief probation officer and deputy district attorney for over 20 years and is a lifetime member of the California Narcotics Officers Association. Her drug court model resulted in one of the lowest recidivism rates in California. In 2005, the Hazleton Company published Ms. Harbert's Community Corrections Workbook for use in prisons. Attorney Carson Fox has been a prosecutor and drug court coordinator. Currently, he works with the Drug Court Planning Institute, sponsored by the Department of Justice. In this capacity, Mr. Fox provides technical assistance to drug courts nationwide, including Juneau, and South America. Before joining the National Drug Court Institute, Mr. Fox served as a prosecutor, helping to implement the first drug court in South Carolina. Thank you.
Thank you. And for the record, Representative Guttenberg is with us in the audience. And David, if you'd like, we have an extra chair if you want to join us in the front. I don't see any other members of either the House or Senate, so we'll start with Helen. Helen, welcome to the Joint Judiciary Committees and to Cold Juneau. If you'll introduce yourself for the record for us, we're very eager to hear your presentation this morning.
Good morning. My name is Helen Harberts, H-A-R-B-E-R-T-S. I am from Butte County, California, and I am a special assistant district attorney in that county of approximately 215,000 people. Because some people may have some precepts about California, and we do come with a bit of a reputation. I am not from the areas of California that is flakes and nuts. Although we do grow more almonds, or almonds as the rest of the world calls them, than most of the rest of the world, I am from a conservative, no-nonsense, law enforcement-based culture in a Central Valley community. In my community, for well over 40 years, the predominant drug of choice has been methamphetamine. We have been far, unfortunately, ahead of the wave of most of the country. In addition, I am in the hometown of California State University at Chico, which made for a number of unfortunate years, including some of the years I attended there, Playboy's top 10 party schools. Out of that somewhat dubious distinction, we have an enormous alcohol problem. And so I wanted to make sure that all of you know that in addition to coming here and discussing drug court modalities and treatment modalities, I have done death penalty cases. I have done a lot of door kicking in my career. I ran a narcotics task force as a chief probation officer. And so I don't come here from the let's all hug them and make them well perspective. I come here from the perspective of a very poor, no-nonsense county. We don't fool with dangerous people where I'm from. So, having said that, I'm also here to acknowledge that Alaska has done extraordinary work in the DUI court field, and that many years ago, my program was one of the first 45 in the United States to treat high-end DUI offenders in little old Butte County, California. And we started using a medication called naltrexone. Who picked up the ball and ran with that? It was Alaska. You guys look for a replicable technology that would work and would work well. And so now when I'm running around the country teaching or doing what I do when I'm not at home prosecuting people, I point to Alaska as the model for people who have figured out what works and did it. And I think that's an extraordinary achievement because it's not easy to get a system-wide approach to a difficult problem that it so clearly has a high lethality index. And so for you guys to come at this with your population is exceptional. And I know your data is probably as exceptional as we see in the rest of the country. Nationally, we have studied drug courts left, right, upside down, backwards, forwards, and inside and out. We have had it studied internally, externally, by some of the preeminent researchers in the nation. We know, without question now, that this model works wherever it's put up and done appropriately, following the technologies that we know and following the research, and will turn out a consistently excellent product and reduce recidivism and protect the public safety for a group of offenders. That group of offenders is a very specific group of offenders. There are pretty much two kinds of people that we deal with in criminal justice. There are people who are addicts, and their addiction drives their criminality. And then there are people who are criminals, who may or may not use drugs. The people who are criminals, who use drugs or who don't, are the monsters among us. They're the ones that we save our prison beds for. They're the ones that we're truly frightened of getting into our homes. And they're the ones that really have to be watched in a different way. The people who are addicted, if they are put in these drug court models and they are not assessed out to be the monsters, they go through this drug court model, we address the underlying disease, we rebuild their structure of their universe, and they actually come out tax-paying citizens. What a concept. Further, nationally, we know from recidivism rates, they're not coming back. Now, after all of these years of sitting and doing all the felony sentencings and looking over down the table and saying, sad to see you back, dude, and then they go to prison again, and then they get out in 3 years, and then you wait 4 months, and you go, sad to see you back, dude. And we sent him to prison again, right, over and over. You know, this is getting bad for you. You should stop this. Well, they can't. Drug courts stop that. And so I really think that it's exceptional to talk about this model and the way you've implemented it. They're smart on crime. They're extremely effective with an addicted population. We know they're amazingly cost-effective. We know they're not coming back. They allow us to save prison space for those who really, you know, we just, they need to live their life in prison. There are some people like that, and we know it works. In addition, and speaking here in the last couple of days, I'm aware that you guys are starting to see what we jokingly in my county refer to as the dreaded drug. Methamphetamine is California's little export to the world. And I know that it's up in here. And I would tell you that among all of the drugs, the only thing I have ever seen work for meth addicts is a drug court model. Nothing else that we ever tried in the 20-some years I've done this business worked. I just bought them prison beds because nothing else worked. Now we've got something that works. And I would encourage you to really look at that technology and apply it, not just to a high-end DUI population, but to these meth addicts who are, by definition, high-end. This technology and these research materials indicate to us that this technology or this replicable model works really, really well on high-end people, felons. In fact, using it on very low-end people is not indicated by the research. It's the high-end guys, the ones who have to be supervised and watched, treated vigorously, held accountable for bad choices quickly, brought back before the judge with a somewhat subtle, "Explain yourself, sir," sort of puckers up the whole room because they don't want to be the next one to explain themselves to the judge. And so it really is a great model. And I saw some of the slices of the demographics that you people are serving, and it's perfect in your DUI courts. These people who are high-end repeat felony offenders, they're the definition of what California would call a high-end repeat felony offender, whose criminality is based in addiction. And left untreated, they'd simply come back and come back and come back, and in the meantime, they kill people on the highways. So intervening in their primary issue, which is not criminality, it's addiction, works. I understand there's someone from the Department of Corrections in the audience. A lot of people will recognize this if you actually read the materials underlying the drug court model. It is old-fashioned probation. It is what John Augustus, the father of probation, was talking about when it was created. But because of the caseloads and the press and the change over the years, probation can no longer do what they used to do working one-on-one with the judge. And so we're really talking a sort of a back-to-the-future thing here, where we go back to what used to work and then couldn't because of the numbers and the drug epidemic. And amazingly enough, you guys can take that to the bank. If you do these things, your recidivism rates will be under 20%. Cha-ching, saves money, saves time, saves people, saves lives. Collateral benefit, reduced recidivism. Reduced FASD, reduced drug-involved children, all reduced. So it has system-wide impact when you implement one of these. Also, when we do it, it reduces the impact on our dependency courts, which with methamphetamine, our dependency courts are a nightmare for us. I don't know what else to tell you about this. It's the greatest thing since sliced bread and mashed potatoes, as far as I can tell. It works. My primary mission over all these years has been to pursue public safety by whatever is most effective. For the first 15 years or so of my career, the thing that was most effective was buying a box in the California prison system and putting people there for 3 or more years. I would buy that to protect the public safety. Now, with a select group, drug courts have replaced that because instead of a 70% recidivism rate, I have a 20% recidivism rate. In my DUI court, I had a 12.9% recidivism rate. And so those things work, and it made sense to me. So as part of a public safety strategy, I think it's just darn hard to be implementing a drug court model in your appropriate populations, and then allowing public safety to pursue the other people who don't fit within this model more aggressively as well. Because there's some people they just need to be monitored.
Thank you. Record for the record, Senator Guest has joined us. We have questions for Ms. Harberts. Representative
Guerra.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Ms. Harberts. I'm also a big supporter of the alternative courts. And you said a couple of things that I just wasn't sure if I understood correctly. First, does naltrexone, did you say naltrexone works on with not just with people who have alcohol problems, but with meth problems also? Or were you just talking about meth and
naltrexone? No, I was talking about meth distinctively. Naltrexone is an opiate antagonist.
Right.
It works extremely well with alcohol and with opiates. So in my courts, and I run a series of these courts that affect different populations, I use them with opiate addicts, a lot of construction workers who are injured and they get hooked on Vicodin, Oxycontin, all those things. We will work with the opiate class using naltrexone. It's a very good pharmaceutical adjunct to heroin addiction as well.
Okay. I wasn't sure about meth.
No, I wish that we had a drug that would work as a compassionate use drug to help methamphetamine addicts, but there isn't one, not yet.
The other question I had was with naltrexone treatment for people with alcohol problems,
mm-hmm.
I received a gut-wrenching phone call yesterday, my staff did, from somebody who can't get into an alcohol treatment program.
Mm-hmm.
And she's struggling, but she can't get into one, and we hear the story periodically around here.
Mm-hmm.
With naltrexone, do you also need, is it just naltrexone that you use to treat the person, or do you also need alcohol treatment and rehab?
Not at all. Naltrexone helps people with cravings, and it allows them to focus on treatment. But the goal of a drug court is to allow people to get into treatment and stick with it. The real work that is done in cognitive behavioral therapies inside treatment. And treatment must go for a year. And treatment isn't fun. And so that's why drug courts work, is because we're really focused on you go to treatment or you'll be chatting with me.
Thanks.
So, no, you've got to get into treatment.
Representative Roekberg has also joined us this morning. Other questions for Helen?
Good morning.
Sure.
Go ahead, Helen. Representative Coghill.
Sure appreciate you coming up here and sharing with us some of your successes. Some of the things I think we struggle with, and I haven't even talked with a sponsor about this necessarily, but, and that is who gets to stand in line at the drug court. And I think we're gonna struggle with that because we have been running mostly pilot type programs at this point. And there's going to come a time where we need to go either full scale or not do it at all, I think. And so how have you dealt with that issue? Or am I off base asking you that?
Not at all. Not at all. When we began our drug courts, I did two things. One of them was that I saw to it that my drug court was taken out of Hyde. And at that time, I was the chief probation officer. I actually wrote our protocol as the chief deputy district attorney. I then became the chief probation officer in my county and served there for 7 years. During that period of time, we implemented all of our problem-solving courts. Each of the courts that I tried to create, I kept my feet in general fund, because grant funding and pilot funding is interesting, but it goes away. And so I worked very, very hard to develop a core budget that was based in general fund. I am an absolute advocate for mainstreaming and general fund basing this type of court program. Because I ran my numbers inside my department, I served at a maximum 250 people in my drug court at one time, and my recidivism rate was 14.9%. And we ran our numbers every year, and we've run them for 10 years. We're now up towards 20%. And then I looked at the recidivism rate off of my standard felony supervision caseload, of which there were approximately 1,700 people. And the recidivism rate there was over 70%. So I backed my numbers up, and I very quickly figured out that if I could bring it up to scale, my department's caseload would drop by half in 5 years. So I saw drug court as the salvation of my department, because probation keeps getting more and more cases, and the drugs don't go away, and there are more things coming at you, and there are more demands on your time, and you look at these people who are very serious, dangerous predators who are on your caseload, and you're trying to choose. So I believe very firmly in mainstreaming this principle, in getting broad-based general fund support. There is a business to be evolved out of this, and it feeds and supports communities, gets people healthy. You get treatment professionals up and hired who you can trust and who understand the criminal justice system and can work with it, and who are outcome-driven. And so I'm a big advocate for mainstreaming, getting good financial footings, and then don't fool around. I'm looking for outcomes and a high amount of people. I'm not a big fan of boutique courts. I want a bunch of people in there, and I want to see outcomes. And they need to be forthwith.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since we have at least something in place, not in every area, of course,
right,
but we do have a key, we have key people in place that are, mm-hmm, are doing this.
Mm-hmm.
When you first started this program, did you have to get hire new people, or did you just train the people that you had to work differently?
Both. The drug court model is counterintuitive. It makes no sense. When I first went to the first training, I went because my boss, who was the elected district attorney, said, yeah, I'm not going. These people are crazy. You have to go. And I said, well, that's not fair. And he said, oh, well. And so it rolled downhill, and I went. And I listened to this group of people come in, and I came to the conclusion that they were one of two things. This was the greatest thing that had come down the pike in a while, or these people were crazy. So I came back and I told my boss, well, these people are either crazy or this thing may work. And if it works, it's really going to be something. So we thought, how much worse could it get than what we were doing? Because we had a big goose egg for success in our county. Everybody who was on our alternative program showed up at a meth lab. I was so busy authorizing complaints about these people, I was just, oh, Lord. So when we started it with an eye on training, because it's backwards. Everything that you do is backwards. For instance, prosecutors don't talk much in court, in drug court. As you can tell, that was quite a challenge for me. It's a whole different technology, but once you get people trained up to it and you get the judges trained up to it and everybody understands it, the training is key. And then you just open the box and execute. And the outcomes just go like this. As we grew, I hired new people. But when we first started, I pulled people off of the main lines who I thought were people who were most capable of learning something that was counterintuitive. And so I took my senior people. Drug court models are not for baby prosecutors and for baby probation officers who are just learning.
Follow-up?
Go ahead.
Just one more question. So for us to really get into this full-time, or maybe not full-time, but to really increase, it would be possible for us to do it with not a whole lot of money?
Your money would be in two probably distinct areas. Your money would be in supervision resources and treatment resources. That's where our capacity goes up. As a district attorney, I sit in my problem-solving courts every week, and I work on as my caseload flows, between about 750 and 900 cases, right around 800 that are sitting on my caseload that I watch through the domestic violence court, the DUI court, the drug court, and my blessing of life, the Prop 36 court. So capacity for a prosecutor isn't a major issue. But for your treatment dollars and your supervision dollars, that's where your growth is. And there's some requirement for court because of the amount of hearings, some of the clerk time. But otherwise, it's a front-loaded program, but the offset on the other end is huge. It's just huge. I keep people out of jail. I only put people in jail for 24 or 48 hours just to sort of refocus their attention when needed. You know, it's a different technology. And it works a lot better. It makes no sense to me, and it will make no sense to anyone in this room, because we don't have the cognitive distortions that the people who are addicted do. But whacking somebody for 24 hours in jail immediately, like right now, versus 10 or 30 days in jail, 24 hours in jail is more effective right now. Can't explain it, but it's true.
For the benefit of the House members, this chairman allows free-flowing conversation as long as you let me know when you're done.
I'm done.
Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've only visited a couple of the courts, and only have seen the result of people who have been there for a pretty long time, and I got to watch one graduation. So there was it was a very, very intensive personal interaction. But at the very beginning, when somebody comes to a DUI court or a drug court, the determination has to be made between the two that you said, and one is an addict doing criminal behavior and a criminal who's an addict. Can you give me some idea of the criteria that you've seen to vet that quickly?
Oh, absolutely. There's assessment instruments which are normed for the corrections population. And that's a technical way of saying there used to be a bunch of risk needs assessments that were actually tested against college students, and everybody came out as Jack the Ripper on them. And so now they have some that are normed against the corrections population, such as the LSIR, and some there's some other public domain instruments. And actually, some places actually have ones that's normed against their local population, so it's even more finite. Maricopa County, Arizona, uses one that's normed against their population. And you go through this, which is an objective-based assessment, and you can pretty much pick out who's the criminal and who's not. Now, I will also tell you that there's a quick and dirty way that I do it. After a few years of doing this and serving as both a probation officer and a DA, I pull out the rap sheet, and I take a look and see where this person's predominant criminal activity has been. And if it has the overwhelming scent of addiction, you're going to see basic theft, basic driving, basic possession type offenses all over it. If I pull out a rap sheet and I see crimes against persons, crimes against property, crimes in all the big categories, I think I have a criminal who has a drug problem. And that's a whole different person. That's the unscientific method. But when I see that, the hair goes up on the back of my neck because I think I may have a criminal. And I will ask them to be assessed using an LSIR, which we use in my county. And it, instead of being a self-report instrument, which is standard use for treatment modalities, this is an objective system that looks at some of their other convictions and is worked against the police reports so that you get a much more accurate view of who is sitting in front of you. There are also the hair psychopathy scale. There are some other things that you can use to determine if you're actually working with a psychopath. The one thing that you don't want to deal with as a criminal justice professional, the one thing you do not want to create is a clean and sober criminal. Making them more effective is an extremely poor strategy. So I pick them out, and the high-end guys who show criminal behavior in other areas, I don't play with them. We have another place for them.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. Thanks for being here. You mentioned earlier that you had some 250 folks in wellness court and about a 20% recidivism rate and 1,700 folks on felony supervision with about a 70% recidivism rate. What is constraining your wellness court to those numbers? Why, if it's working so well there, hasn't it sort of swallowed up the felony supervision such that you have more folks in wellness court than in felony supervision?
Two things. One of them is I'm going against the existing paradigm of what people like. There is a long-standing tradition in the criminal justice system of threatening people and whacking them. You do this, and you say, if you do this, I'm going to send you to prison. And then they violate, and you say, and now I'm getting really, really serious, and if you do this, I'm going to send you to prison. And then in the end, they say, I told you 6 times, and now I'm sending you to prison. And then the only person in the room who's shocked is the addict, because they don't get that. They don't respond to that. So it is very difficult to change a long-standing criminal justice paradigm. And also, one is very cautious about picking who to treat. The other thing is that my county has 3 times prepared filings for bankruptcy to have the state take us over, because we literally have no money. And so when I go in and say, I need $100,000 for urine testing, I cannot tell you how little curb appeal that has. No one wants to spend $100,000 on urine testing. And so it's actually a fiscal issue in part. And it's a, we don't do it that way because we've never done it that way issue, no matter how much data is stacked up in front. Now, on the other hand, there are 850 people that I'm supervising in my courts now. So my little old county's made some changes. They're just not big enough.
And how many years has your program been in effect?
My first program, which was the Butte County Drug Cart, started in 1995, June 1st, 1995.
So with a decade of experience, I'm just imagining that you can go to the fiscal powers that be and demonstrate enormous savings in prison mm-hmm. beds, correctional officers, health mm-hmm. benefits for the same, and so forth.
I absolutely can. And they said, how wonderful, and thank you for contributing to the county. It helped us fund other things. Also, there are different cost centers that are saved. I have done an extraordinary job saving the state of California money, because they're the ones who pay for prisons. My county doesn't. And I'm sure the state is very grateful, but Governor Schwarzenegger has forgotten to send the check, because our prisons are still at 300% capacity. And so they need that money, and they're just grateful I didn't send anyone else. But I think it's more of a gee, thanks for the team effort. It takes vision and leadership, like you guys have shown with your DUI courts, when you see this massive problem, and you are willing to address it. And there are still a fair amount of people that I work with who have a bit of the ostrich syndrome. And on the other hand, they built me a nice, big, beautiful juvenile hall with 120 beds, so I can't complain too much, because they spent $17-18 million on that, because I needed a new juvenile hall. So the county spends where they believe their priority is.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You've had a lot of experience in different drugs, and because meth has been going on for a long, long time, is there anything else that works with meth? Or is this the only thing that you know of that does work with it? And because we have a big problem with that in this state, so I'm just wondering.
I have never seen anything that works with methamphetamine except the drug court model. I have seen people on opiates do okay in some settings. I have seen a percentage, not a great percent, but a percentage of people who are alcoholics do okay in a traditional setting. There is nothing that I have seen works with methamphetamine except the drug court model. Because methamphetamine harms the brain in a distinct way, we know that methamphetamine addicts are arrested more frequently than other addicts. We know that 67% of them are polysubstance abusers. We know that when they're arrested, they stay in jail longer. We know that they take longer in treatment than any other addict because of the nature of the injury to their brain. Their brains are truly insulted by this drug. They have short-term memory deficits, they have long-term memory deficits, they have crushing depression. They have, at least for up to a year, active both auditory and visual hallucinatory processes that will come on very suddenly with very little warning. They have a very strong post-acute withdrawal syndrome, and they really need a full continuum of treatment in order to get well. Fortunately, if you can stick with them for that long and keep them in treatment for that long, you can get really good outcomes. because that's pretty much what my court is. My drug court is 87.7% methamphetamine addicts. And you can get really awesome outcomes. But that year that you're working with those people, only by the force of the court and consistent work with the treatment team can you get them to stay that long. They can't remember. They can't remember to go. They are so depressed they can barely breathe. Their brain is telling them, you know, the last time we felt this bad, we went out and got some meth, and then we felt a little closer to normal. And so it's an extremely difficult challenge for them. And the only thing I've seen is the coerced treatment model. You know, there's the door A, which would be the door to the jail. And there's the door B, which is the door to the drug court or your wellness court. And your choice is one or two. And if it's put that way to them every couple weeks, they're fairly able to focus on the door to health. But much longer than that, they just run. It's really sad.
Thank you.
Representative Coghill.
My question is probably two different arenas. The first one is, since working with the specialty courts in both drugs and in alcohol DUIs, have you seen a change in treatment models that matched what the court was doing? Because I think some of the struggles we've had in Alaska is we've tried funding treatments, but we didn't know how to get to the outcomes. Certainly there has to be a nexus between the court model and treatment models.
One of the best things that I have seen come out of the drug court model is an insistence on research-based practices and on excellence. And so the things that I did 10 years ago in my drug court, I don't do now, because I know that there's a better way, and we get smarter and faster about our work every couple years as the research comes out. And so one of the things that started to happen was I started focusing on my treatment partners and saying, yeah, what is it you're doing? Yeah, that didn't work. Why are you doing that? Here's the research, here's the studies, we need to be doing this. And we brought them along and started insisting, what are you doing, and is it assessment-based, and is it research-based? Show me the evidence, because I don't think treatment by Ouija board works. You know, we don't do kumbaya treatment. We get in the room and we do hard work, cognitive restructuring. We know that methamphetamine addicts have to be treated in shorter bursts because they cannot pay attention, they can't sit, right, because they can't remember. So you treat a methamphetamine addict for no longer than 30 minutes at a time. It's called Cognitive Behavioral Therapies Light, CBT Light. And that's an emerging technology based on research. Same thing with alcohol. So we absolutely insist that people are up to speed. And you know what? If they're not, and if they can't give us a replicable technology for treatment that is evidence-based, they don't play with my team. They go find the money somewhere else, because we're carrying the taxpayers' dollars here, and I want the bang for my buck, and I want the best possible outcomes, because I have to answer to a bunch of people for this, including my elected official, who will be above the fold on the newspaper if something goes wrong. So you've got to insist on evidence-based practices and hold them accountable. And we audit files. We do all of those things to make sure that what they say they're doing, they're doing.
Mr. Chairman, that's something that we're definitely going to be working on. I mean, that's a work in progress. The other thing that I was curious from your working perspective is getting judges included in the vision part of it, because it definitely takes a lot of work, mm-hmm. and it's a different model than sitting at a bench judging between appeals to the law and application of the law.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting puzzle. And the interesting puzzle to me is that traditionally the judiciary is the slowest moving and most conservative branch of our government. And it is the bellwether against the wide swings. And so our founding fathers correctly, I think, designed a system that allows us to have the three different branches working, and the traditional quiet one, or the slower moving one, has been the bench. And that has worked very well, but it doesn't work here. And so when you really look at it, you've got to keep talking to the judges and maybe give them a break. In California, judges are rated on how fast they can move a caseload. How many caseloads do you move? How fast do you move the cases in a certain day? What churning are you doing? They're not rated on outcome. So when I ask a judge to spend about 75 to 90 seconds with a client, an alarm bell is going off in the back of the judge's head. Now, we move our drug court calendars pretty effectively. We have about 120 lines a day. There's a lot of people coming up in front of us. And the judge is well primed by the team, and so the judge knows, has a complete report in front of them, knows exactly what they're going to say. We've staffed it. But in terms of churning, it's not a churning court. So what they're taught to do, to stay impartial, to stay removed, to not build a relationship, to never ask an open-ended question. How many lawyers in this room were told, never ask a question you don't already know the answer to? That is counterintuitive to what we teach a drug court judge. So it's hard to get them to see it, and then once they see it, the whole world clarifies, and you can pick people out who need treatment. So it's really about training judges and also allowing them to use a model that doesn't count widgets. It counts recidivism.
Representative Roquebrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome. In Alaska, one of the biggest problems we've had and in most of our experience at the DUI level has been the cultural conflict between, let's say, prosecutors, corrections officers, probation officers, and other members of the team to bring this apart. Do you have any recommendations or suggestions to us of how you can break down those barriers of changing the paradigm? Like you mentioned, it's counterintuitive. How can we overcome this resistance on the part of the prosecutors and the corrections people that change their attitude?
Well, I can tell you that I insisted on a place at the table because I thought all these people were crazy. And so I wanted to watch them just in case somebody did something crazy, because I was there to protect public safety even if the judge went nuts, right? I mean, that was why I was there, and that's what I told my boss. And when I began to watch the data and the outcomes, then I realized that there was something to this. And so what I did was I figured that my prosecutorial hat just needed to look a little different, because we're still all about public safety and doing the right thing. And if this absolutely does that, then it's simply another tool in my chest. I do things in the problem-solving courts that I would have never done. But I don't care, because it works, right? So I walk up to somebody who is, frankly, for all intents and purposes, a creep. They're all tatted up. They're from the California prison systems. And I say, I'm glad you're here today. Now, that's a little bizarre, but it works because the DA acknowledged that they showed up, so I do it. It is a cultural clash of some sort, and it's not at the same time, because we're still in that same fundamental business. It's just that prosecutors and corrections also have jurisdiction to pay attention to monsters. And I look at this as just one tool, one piece of the puzzle. I don't think the corrections can do an entire drug court model, because it sets aside the very dangerous people that we have to really watch closely. Now, there are some people, to be blunt, you just got to hunt them like a hound and bring them down. There's no polite way to put that. They're dangerous, they hurt people, and you've got to watch them. Training and education, working with other people, being at the table is the key, and being willing to listen to the other technologies. And watching the outcome. I sit at my table in part to make certain that we stay on the mission that we initially accomplish: public safety.
Go ahead.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. What have you been able to use in terms of technology, in terms of electronic monitoring, interlocks, various things of this nature? Are there new elements coming about that have been effective? Could you speak to that?
Well, like many people, we use the SCRAM for the DUI courts. My county is extremely mountainous in some areas. Cell phones, radios, things like that don't work. So some of the GPS technologies we cannot take good advantage of, because you can disappear in my county. And some of my rural areas, I have no transportation for clients into. But we do use the SCRAM. We do use some differing. We're not yet up to using ETG for ethylglucuronide testing for alcohol because we can't afford it.
Could you, I'm not sure I understand that. Could you translate the acronym, please?
Yes, ETG, ethylglucuronide, is a new type of drug testing which detects urine metabolites of alcohol for a number of days. One of the problems with DUI offenders is that alcohol dissipates from the human body at a rate of 0.02 per hour. And so a person can be under the influence at midnight and be in your office at 8:30 and not show any alcohol. And so you say, are you clean? Oh, yeah. That's why you have the SCRAM. But when people go off that SCRAM, they may start cheating. There is now a test that we can pull the metabolites out of urine, and we can get a good window on use for 3 days. So I can't afford that yet, but I know ETG is coming down in price, and I'll be able to get a hold of that technology soon. And that will provide me with a much better window. Because most of our DUI offenders and our drug addicts are polysubstance abusers, we also cross-test for a number of other things. And we do aggressive community supervision, so it's not unusual for someone to hear at 10 at night and some smiling face is sitting there with a breath test saying, hi, blow, and then come back an hour later and say, did I forget my flashlight? Oh, I'm here. Blow! It just keeps everyone focused on our mission.
Thank you very much, Representative Guerra.
Just only briefly, if you can, but you talked about meth, but you didn't mention what the recidivism rate reduction has been, if any, in your courts for people with meth problems. And then with meth, I take it you don't treat the kingpin dealer, but you maybe treat the user or minor dealer?
That's right. My recidivism rates are all not specific to the drug. They are an overall. But you can probably figure out that if 87.7% of my drug court is methamphetamine users, that recidivism rate of now less than 20% after 10 years would apply to them. This is a small conservative county. We do not treat people who were armed or have guns, who commit what California calls serious or violent felonies. They are users who commit felonies. Everyone in my drug court is a felon, literally with 1 foot in state prison right now. So, but it's a variety of crimes. They're low-end burglaries, which means they're not residential. They haven't been in somebody's house. They're forgers. They're thieves. They're low-end dealers. The only thing that we have a barrier for is manufacturing. And over the years, I've come to think that that might be a small mistake because some of our manufacturing is very small and local. And that came from a time when all of our labs were biker labs or Mexican national labs. And as we tighten up on ephedra, that is actually going away. And so what I'm getting is a lot of mom-and-pop labs. And those are driven by addiction, not by commercial. So if you're out for business and you're going to sell drugs and prey on other people and literally be willing to kill other people's children, I will not treat you. You're a criminal. You go to jail.
Helen, we want to thank you very much for being here and giving us this presentation today.
Thank you.
And hope you can come back and visit us sometime when it's a little warmer.
Yeah, the breeze is a little stiff here.
Thank you very much. Thank Janet, who is your next presenter this morning?
Carson Fox.
Welcome to the combined judiciary committees of the House and Senate. Mr. Fox, welcome to Juneau. And if you'll introduce yourself for the record, we're eager to hear your presentation this morning as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senators, Representatives. My name is Carson Fox, FOX. I work in Alexandria, Virginia. I'm actually from South Carolina, and I was sitting over there thinking, how did a South Carolina country boy get in front of this committee today? And basically, problem solving or drug courts is what brought me here. I was a prosecutor in the 11th Circuit of South Carolina in the mid-90s, and we started looking, trying to find something that would work better to address the addiction in our community. We had a big problem with crack cocaine. And my boss, the elected DA, we called them solicitors, I think we're still the only state left that calls them solicitors, went out and found out about drug courts. And this was back when there were only 12, 15 drug courts in the country. And then he brought that information back to the office, and I was tasked with starting this drug court program. And it's just been an amazing process since then, and I've actually seen the programs grow. Helen covered so much information for y'all that really the big thing that's left is just to kind of put it in a, just to take a step back and put it in a broader perspective. In 1989, the first of these programs started in Miami, Florida, because the problem there with cocaine was so significant, they literally gave a judge a sabbatical to go and figure out how in the world can we deal with this. And the idea that he came back with is, if we monitor folks closely and have them continue to report in front of a judge on a continuous basis while they're getting intensive treatment, I think that'll work. It worked so well that we saw it grow to 12 courts by 1994, and today, and I think you may have the information in packets, today we've got almost 2,000 courts. And that's basically in 15 years we've seen it grow from one court in Miami that was a pilot, and you've used the word pilot earlier, to almost 2,000 courts. We've also got, I think it was mentioned in my biography that I've been to South America, and you can imagine how I felt then being in South America. I was literally outside playing with my Labrador Retriever one day and got a call that nobody else could go, and they said, will you go to South America? I couldn't even imagine. But they have them down there because it works. It's amazing. It's just amazing to me to see them in countries all over the world using the model and adapting them to what their existing laws are because the model seems to work. Mr. Chairman, when I started working with drug courts, the evaluation material that we had was really limited to local programs. There were local programs that could show it seems like it works here. That's all we could do with our program. We actually got, I was the prosecutor, the defense attorney's office managed to get what they considered to be, it looked like our recidivism rate locally, which was for the offenders we were going for, which were multiple felony offenders. We wanted people who were farther down the continuum because we considered those folks to be a greater threat to public safety. Their recidivism rate was between 45% and 65%. And we were hoping, looking at the few numbers we had seen, maybe we could cut that to below 50%. When I left the program, our recidivism rate was below 20%, very similar to Helen's. So we had cut it to a third, actually far less than a third. And I was amazed, but we started that. But now what we've seen with the research is, like any other field that grows as quickly as drug courts, the research has had to catch up. And there's been some amazing national studies done. The National Institute of Justice did a study, and IJ did a study in the last couple of years where they looked at over 2,000 drug court graduates from across the country to see, well, what, if we take a step back, what are these recidivism rates nationwide? And they found phenomenal numbers. I think after 1 year it was 16%, and after 2 years it was around 25%. We've had states that have been able, maybe not necessarily to go to scale, but to get closer to going to scale. New York comes to mind. In the New York Unified Court System, and they have, they require every jurisdiction to have a problem-solving court. And I was floored. I read their study, and their cost-benefit analysis showed that they saved annually $250 million a year by implementing programs that, I mean, the studies show that the problem-solving courts cost a little more on the upfront because of the treatment, but they looked actually at cost-benefit. So they looked at what happens afterwards, and it was amazing. It's so amazing, like I said, that they actually said, the Chief Justice there said, let's have these in every jurisdiction. We've seen cost-benefit analysis start from individual programs, like Multnomah County in Portland, Oregon. They did a cost-benefit analysis back in the mid to late 90s, and they determined that for every dollar they spent on drug court programs, they were saving $10 on the back end. We saw a very similar study come out of Dallas, Texas, where the program there had an analysis done, a cost-benefit study done of their program. They showed that for every dollar they spent, they saved $9.41 on the back end. Then we started to see the statewide cost-benefit analysis being done. I can tell you that probably one of the last times I sat in front of a body like this one, it was on a county level in my county, and the question came up for Helen, how could you go to your county and talk about the cost-benefit? I was able to do that. It was amazing. I came from a jurisdiction, when I was a prosecutor, the main county in my jurisdiction, they had 95% of our population, was the second most conservative county in the country when I was working there. It was a poll that was taken in the late 90s. And I went to them. We asked them for money to try to start a drug court program because we wanted to see what we could do. We had, just like so many jurisdictions, the jails were filled up, and this looked like it would work. So we started one on a pilot basis. We were able to go in a couple of years later with the data that we had collected, and for the first time, actually the finance person for the county told me that he had never seen county council vote to fund a new program based on data ever in his years and years with the county until he saw the data we put in front of him. It even amazed me, just the amount of money we had been able to save. Jail beds, on and on. And that's pretty much why I'm here today. I know that y'all have got a lot of questions. Honestly, we came in yesterday, Helen and I trained local court here, and one of the pieces we trained on was behavior modification. We also did some training on confidentiality and ethics. And I was explaining to them yesterday, and I'm thinking the same thing today. Both of those topics, I could do a 2 or 3 day training on behavior modification. We had an hour. And so I feel like we have some of the same time constraints this morning. There's so much that we could tell you, so I don't know. Whatever y'all want to know, I'll try.
I just as soon as you didn't talk to my wife, she's been trying to modify my behavior for a long time. Questions for Mr. Fox. Representative Coghill.
Since you worked in the prosecutor, how many times does the coercive power of the state have to come down on somebody who fails in the drug court?
It really depends on the individual. I know that I've probably seen 100 different programs across the country. In my program in general, there were some folks who might have gotten out with a couple of sanctions, and we call them sanctions in the program, with a couple of sanctions in 18 months. There are other folks that take more. It takes more to get their attention. When these programs started back in the early 90s, back in 1989 and on, what we saw were most of them were diversion programs where they were taking offenders who might not be multiple felony offenders. As the program started to work and you moved into the late 90s, we see more and more programs doing what actually you've been doing in Alaska all along, which is taking people who are farther down the continuum because it protects public safety. We've actually seen the model work better with those people. But what it means in some circumstances is the court is having to respond maybe more often to those individuals. But what we've also seen is there's actually a study that came out very recently specific to drug court that showed that this intervention of the judge works with that population of folks, and nothing else seems to work. If you take people who are down the continuum criminal justice and have maybe failed out of treatment several times before, they're a very difficult population of folks to work with. And it seems that this judge component, adding that in there, actually in drug court is the only thing that seems to work. And that was a study done by Dr. Doug Marlowe in Pennsylvania, and he's done criminal justice treatment research for years and actually did that research specific to drug court. So it really just depends, and it's actually interesting. Maybe with a more involved population you'll see it more, but at the back end you'll see more interventions, and the idea is to get the intervention in as quickly as possible, make it seem fair, but also make it be quick, and to get the behavior modification.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
I'm probably the wrong one to ask this question because I haven't gotten that close to our courts here in Alaska. But as we get into sanctions, there must be a rising level of sanction that comes before you finally say you're going to have to go back to jail. And have you found a tipping point that says we can see this coming, or has it been that individualistic?
In many cases, it's individualistic. There are some programs that will designate certain things that may get someone kicked out immediately, and it may be based on other types of issues. It tends to be, though, to the individual, very individualistic. Where are they in the program? How long have they been in treatment? What are your expectations at that point in time? But eventually, in any program, there are going to be people who don't succeed. Nationally, if you look at these programs, you might have 70% of folks succeeding, which is maybe four times as successful as some other interventions with the same populations of folks. Even if you've got a 70% success rate, it means that 3 out of 10 people are not going to make it, and those are people that you are. You're basically saying, okay, you've come to the end of our tether, and then you're out of the program. But it is going to be on an individual person-by-person basis, unless in certain programs there's just one thing you could do, you know, leave the jurisdiction, or if there's some particular thing that you could do where they'll say, okay, well, now we can't deal with you anymore. Could depend on the program, could depend on what target population, who are the folks you're dealing with. And so a lot of times it's program to program. They decide what their cutoff is going to be because their population is different. Their jurisdiction is different. So it ends up being individual.
We deal with several kind of continuing issues. We have certainly methamphetamine and other drugs are on the rise. Alcohol has been a huge, huge issue. But there are those who medicate based on mental health issues. And so you have the criminal who's an addict, you have an addict who does criminal behavior, and then you have people who have mental issues where they're somewhere along the line going to need constant supervision, either to do their own medication that is legal or they're going to go out and do some criminal medications. Is there a way that you have found to move from, say, one court where they're held accountable for a criminal action, they have this penalty over them, but they move to a place where in the mental health arena they move into a continuum of supervision?
I've seen judges who do both mental health courts and drug courts, and I'm hoping I'm understanding your question. I've actually seen them deal with similar populations, and what you'll see in some jurisdictions, if you talk to judges who do both programs at the same time, they'll actually find out occasionally they have to switch someone from a drug court over to a mental health court. They'll determine that the person actually needs a higher level of supervision because they have a mental illness that maybe manifests itself or they're later on, and they're moved over to mental health court. And what you'll see in mental health court oftentimes is just what you said. Those folks need more supervision for a longer period of time because you are talking about different issues. It doesn't mean that you'll have people in drug court programs that don't have lower level mental illness or issues, but when you're dealing in mental health courts, you're dealing with people whose primary issues are their mental illness issues, and they are going to need more supervision, longer period of time. The team needs to be knowledgeable of what those issues are, and so it's a different population of folks that the people that are working with them need to recognize them.
Mr. Chairman, I suppose that's going to be part of the training that the courts will get under behavior modification. And those are some of the things that we'll be looking at in our health and social service budget on where we can put our best dollars for behavior modification, both in health courts, whether family court, DUI court, mental health courts, and in programs that can work with them. Which I don't know that we've arrived at very well in Alaska yet, and it's probably something that the whole country's trying to figure out. But I think based on your training, we're going to have to start looking at what you folks have created for criteria based on behavior modification. Certainly you have the coercive power, but we'll have to see how the non-coercive treatment programs work in concert with that. And I don't know that we have a very clear picture of that. So just thank you for coming before us. I guess we'll be looking at your aspect of it and trying to figure out how the bridge to the other side works.
Thank you.
Representative Roquebert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Cockhill brings up some very good points here that have to do with the number one, the sanctions and how we do it. I think up here in Janet, correct me if I'm wrong here, when you get a UI test that tests positive, you get bounced out of the court. By and large, is that how we do.
Or you get sent to jail for a while.
Right.
You start to get a sanction.
Right, that's why I wanted to ask Mr. Fox is the balance between sanctions and carrots, if you will, or positive reinforcement. In Alaska, we're looking at trying to grant a limited driver's license in certain circumstances. Do you think that's an effective carrot and a positive thing to try to work into a program? And you have some experience with that?
What I've seen working with programs in the country is it actually ends up being jurisdictionally. In Alaska, where you've got a huge territory and people pretty much have to drive to get places. I mean, I've worked in some jurisdictions, with some jurisdictions, for example, Charlotte, North Carolina. In their drug court, they've got public transportation all over the city, and so it wasn't necessary when they were dealing with DUI offenders. But I work in a lot of jurisdictions, most jurisdictions now, that have DUI courts are rural. How do folks get places? Do you expect them to be somewhere that's spread out? In my jurisdiction, I had a huge county that had 6,000 people. There was no way they could get anywhere. And we had no way. There was no statutory way in South Carolina that we could get them provisional licenses. And so it wasn't out there, and it was very difficult. And some people actually had to end up leaving. They had to quit the program because they couldn't find rides. They couldn't get places. We had people who carpooled with each other and tried, and then you've got a big issues that appear there because you're trying to get folks who don't have transportation maybe to treatment three or four times a week. They've got their job on top of that. And maybe they're coming to court once a week and once every 2 weeks. They may have to go report to probation once a week. But if they do a sanction, they've got, maybe got community service once a week or something on top of that. They may also have to go to job training or what have you. And there's lots of places that they're having to need to go, work and treatment being the main ones, work, treatment, and court being the main ones. And how accessible is that? So really it just comes down to where are you and how possible is it for them to get around? If someone can't get there, if you can't get someone to treatment, you can't treat them.
Senator, go ahead. Senator Roper.
In Alaska, we do have all three types of courts right at this juncture. But the legislature has been very supportive, or I'd say, of the DUI level. We've had federal funding for the mental health and the drug courts, but they're coming to an end. So how have other jurisdictions handled this, you mentioned multiple users or multiple problem clients, if you will, in terms of the coordination between the courts? How does that work?
Again, that depends on the jurisdiction and how best they're set up, because you'll have the court systems will be completely different in some jurisdictions. For example, probation in some states falls under the judiciary, and other states it falls under the executive branch. So it can be very different. What you see is just a coordination of services on the local level within these courts. And it just, whatever that coordination is, there's what's called the 10 key components of drug court, which was put together several years ago, which defines what these programs are. And one of those key components is the training piece we talked about. Another one is it's just coordination. And you have to look locally at what resources are available. And so if you've got three or four programs in Helen's jurisdiction, she's got several programs. You've got a jurisdiction where you can coordinate all these in one area. You may have a larger city with dozens and dozens of programs, a smaller city where they're able to do it all in one courtroom. And so it's really ends up being jurisdictionally, like I mentioned, in some mental health courts where one judge is handling mental health and drug court, the judge can be over actually seeing that someone's transferred from one to the other. I've also seen judges cooperate who were doing it in the same jurisdiction, but one was doing mental health court, one was doing drug or DUI court, and they realized that someone had a mental health issue that really was more than the drug court could deal with, and they would transfer that person within and have them assigned to a higher level of supervision. But there has to be a level of cooperation at the local level to recognize those issues, because every locality is going to be different. I've done technical assistance here with Anchorage and Bethel. Anchorage and Bethel are very different. And so the way that if they had those issues, they would have to coordinate those locally. What would work in Anchorage might not work in Bethel, and vice versa. When I was in South Carolina, but what might work in Columbia, South Carolina, might not work in Hilton Head or Myrtle Beach. We had to look at the jurisdictions and what were the realities there with transportation, et cetera.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
With your experience with Bethel in Anchorage, and interesting enough, one of the problems we have up here, we've got a felony level at Superior Court, and then we've got a misdemeanor level at the district court level. Has that caused a problem with your experience?
I've actually seen
it. Or what have they done in Bethel? Have they forgotten about that distinction, or how does that work?
I've seen it work both ways. I've seen some I've worked with some jurisdictions where it's set up just like that, and there's a judge on a superior court level or a circuit court level who handles the felony cases in a drug court, and then there's a judge at district court level, they're called different levels in different states, who handles misdemeanors. And I've worked with some jurisdictions where a general jurisdiction judge handles both. They handle whatever gets put into the program. I've worked with some jurisdictions where there's a judge who, there's so many cases, all the judge hears are problem-solving court cases. You know, if you've got a jurisdiction where they've gone to scale, one that comes to mind is Fort Lauderdale. They have, I think, 1,900 people in their program. So they have one judge there because it's 2,000 cases. I mean, they're constantly hearing cases. So it would depend on the jurisdiction. But I've actually seen it work well in both cases. It depends on what resources they have. If you've only got one judge, you've only got one judge. But if you have judges who can split it out, it depends on the jurisdiction.
Mr. Chairman, in Alaska, we've had to go to the Department of Health and Social Services, or ASAP program, as a primary case coordinating in the screening agency. It's kind of a shame, in a sense, but at least we've got found some departments to take the bull by the horns. But Mr. Fox, with your experience, is there a distinction between the DUI court and the drug court in the types of treatment, or is there? I'm more familiar with the DUI model than the drug model. Is there a particular treatment element or an element of the drug model that we should focus on to help to lead that to success?
It is a different population. It's when you're dealing with people who are alcoholics, alcohol is a drug. There's no doubt about that. Alcohol is a drug, and it's a very insidious drug. It's amazing the way it affects the body. But we actually did, from the National Drug Court Institute, different trainings for DUI or DWI courts and drug courts, because treatment can be different. Testing, and Helen covered this, the testing is very different. If someone, for example, if I'm using cocaine, a standard drug test can pick that up sometimes 3 days later. In alcohol, within hours, it's gone. So just supervision, and Helen mentioned that's one of the largest funding areas, that creates a huge issue for supervision, because you have a much shorter window period of time. You've got folks, the target populations are sometimes very different. What people look like, the resources they come with into the, you'll have people, maybe someone who's arrested, typically sometimes people who are alcoholics who have been caught with DUI, they've been arrested with DUI, they may still have jobs and they're still functioning. And somebody who's that far along in methamphetamine may not even be living, they may not have a place to live. And so there's all different issues. There are case management issues, what educational issues, on and on, that ends up being issues. And then treatment issues, too. You're dealing with people, just one example, and I'm not a psychopharmacologist, Mr. Chairman, but from a prosecutor's point of view, what fascinated me in learning about how these chemicals impact the brain is that drugs like methamphetamine and cocaine will sometimes do the damage to your brain in a 6 month period of time that alcohol may take 20 years to do. So it's a different group of folks.
There's your questions,
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Fox. I know in Anchorage there we have what's called a Veterans Court. Judge Murphy started that about 2.5 years ago, and I think it's been relatively successful, appears to be somewhat based on the model that you've cited here. My question for you is, when it comes to demographics, gender, age, ethnic groups, in South Carolina or any other venue, that have you seen any traits that pop out based on analysis of cross-sections of demographics, either by crime or by treatment?
There are, again, and when drug courts started, they started as grassroots. Individual communities were starting them. So what you'll see is that the populations will differ from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. I can give you a good example. I was working with a jurisdiction in the Northeast a couple of years ago, and when they were describing their jurisdiction to me, they said, picture a donut. They said, we've got an island in the middle of this harbor where there's a bridge to it. Everybody on the island is like in the upper one half of 1% income group. And then we've got the area around it, which is very crime infested. And it was basically a bridge that just went over there. So you didn't even have to go through that area. You went over this bridge to get to the island. in this one jurisdiction, which kind of paints the picture of jurisdictions everywhere, they were dealing with two populations of folks. They had upper-income kids on this island who were dabbling in heroin. So they were finding 21, 22, 23, 24-year-old kids who were involved in the heroin scene because they could get it, they could afford it. A lot of times they might not have been in the system until they were way far down the road because they've stole their grandmother's silver tea service and they've stole their mom's jewelry over and over again, and no one's ever reported it to the police until finally something happens. Then you've got this group around them. The group around the island were all in crack cocaine. Obviously, they didn't have educations, no place to live. Their populations were totally different. So that's one example of where even in one jurisdiction, what the folks look like is totally different. You really can't. But what's important is the people working in that jurisdiction recognize that. They know we have got two peaks, we have two groups of folks. We have to have services available for, first of all, heroin, specific drug. It has 89% relapse rate. Treating it different than treating people, who have addictions to crack cocaine. We've got people in this outside area who don't have educations. We know that maybe getting them a GED is going to help them long-term stay off drugs. They had to have those issues taken care of, et cetera, and they had to be able to deal with it with both populations. People locally know that. I mean, people in the local jurisdiction, when I was a prosecutor, Mr. Chairman, I would know in South Carolina, you asked me about South Carolina, I had part of my jurisdiction where there was actually still people were practicing voodoo. And it sounds funny, but we had areas in the jurisdiction where families had been there for 300 years. And so practices they had brought, that their great-great-great-great-grandfathers had brought in were there, very different cultures. I had people who had never left their county, their father's fathers, et cetera, had never left the town that they lived in. I had to recognize that. And I knew my jurisdiction. And then I had a very affluent part of the jurisdiction where we had a 0.5% unemployment rate. So I was going from 17% unemployment to almost no unemployment in one jurisdiction. And so I had basically the programs looked very different. Job training, everything, something that might not be an issue here was a huge issue just a few miles away. So it ends up being a local phenomenon.
Go ahead, Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fox, as I recall, Helen mentioned that 87.7% of your jurisdiction dealt with meth. And the multiple states that I've talked to that have come to grips and reduced the incidence of meth, the backfill has been Mexican ice. I'm sure there's different, my assumption is generally the same thing made by different people and just moved a little longer distance for marketing. My question for you has to do with marijuana. We have a unique profile when it comes to marijuana, but I'm not asking about Alaskans unless you have some information on that. But in the jurisdictions that you're familiar with, where marijuana played a role, could you describe to me what that role is as you see it?
One of the pieces with marijuana is that a lot of folks, when they think about marijuana, they think about the way marijuana was back in the 1960s. Marijuana these days can be 10 times more potent. So you see more and more people being admitted to emergency rooms with overdoses, people becoming addicted. The marijuana now is so pure and so potent, it's just a totally, I've heard psychopharmacologists, and again, I'm not a psychopharmacologist, they will say that the marijuana nowadays is really virtually a totally different drug than what it was 20 years ago. It's just a totally different drug. And so you will find people who are in these programs who are being treated for marijuana addiction, and oftentimes they might be polysubstance abusers. In my program, I remember people who were finding themselves smoking marijuana two or three times a day, 5 or 6 days a week. They were in college, they failed out, they got caught stealing. So they were kids who were good kids, who ended up, and we were prosecuting them because they had stolen something and they came into our program. I remember one kid who was going to Clemson, and he lived in my jurisdiction, and I told him, if you can get into college here, you have to be here to go through this program, and I'll let you go through it. He had to find, Carolina let him in, and he came and he stayed home with his folks and went through it, but marijuana was his drug of choice, and it wasn't the norm in my jurisdiction. Like I said, he was actually the far, far exception, because most of the folks that we had were multiple felony offenders. But his choice, he had gotten into a diversion program with the prosecutor's office, and he had failed out of that because he was so addicted to marijuana he couldn't make it through. They even would tell him in the diversion program when he was going to be drug tested a couple of weeks ahead of time. He was so hooked on it, he would test positive, knowing 3 weeks out he would test positive. This guy was going to go to jail, and he had no record. He was going to jail, and that was the only reason he actually went into the drug court. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been eligible because he wasn't far enough down the road. But he came in, and a year later in treatment, he graduated, and then he went on and graduated from college. So it is out there, and it can be an issue, but again, it's individual to individual. We also had people who were using marijuana who were far down the road and were into everything else. They might have been using three or four drugs, and they were using marijuana as well.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, one more question. The business of addict versus criminal. I drew the conclusion, I think I heard Helen say that, but in any event, that if you're an addict who's stealing to maintain your addiction, or you're a person that's a criminal that happens to use, appears to me the end is the same. Maybe the treatment's different. I don't know, because they're still breaking into people's homes, stealing things, and you know, we as a society do not want to put up with that. Your thoughts?
I'm not an expert in the assessment pieces that Helen talked about. Where the main piece I can think of where that became an issue for me, just in my court, in my program, was individuals who maybe got arrested for dealing, and I think I mentioned we were dealing with crack cocaine. I went to law enforcement and had the DAs and law enforcement, we were sitting around the table trying to figure out who we were going to treat, who we were going to use. And we mentioned, well, we can't deal with anybody who's ever sold drugs. And then somebody from law enforcement said, but you know what? The people that we have that are the worst addicted people are the people who buy one rock of crack cocaine and break off a piece and sell that so they can continue their addiction. They have no place to live, and they're living on the street and on and on. And so it was the difference between, and I think Helen did mention this, the folks who were in it for profit and the folks who were basically living on the street, living in the gutter, the junkies. And that's when I went and talked to law enforcement about drug court. I would ask them. I would walk into a room and I would say, look, I'm not here to sell you on this. I'm here just to tell you what it is we're going to try. And I would ask them, have you arrested anybody in the last 2 weeks who you've arrested a dozen times in the last 15 years? Somebody who's strung out, who's always strung out, who's always in the trouble, who shoplifts all the time, who's, you know, always high, wandering the streets. And they were all nodding their heads. They knew those people. And I said, those are the people we want. I want people you've arrested a lot, who, you know, are constantly in the system, who are just a pain in the butt, who can't seem to get clean, who won't stay in treatment. Because I want those people, because long term, they're the biggest threat to public safety. They're the biggest drain on the resources. I want them in the program. And those are the folks we were looking for. Helen's much more articulate on talking about the assessment pieces and all, but for us, that's what it came down to, that's what it meant. I wanted those folks. I didn't want the people who were selling for profit and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Go ahead. Mr. Chair, one final. And I'll just speak based on reading about Anchorage and a little bit of experience, but in our case, fairly large city, that I think our population is the most skeptical when it comes to how we deal with young people, because when they see and hear the accounts, they perceive a much more hardened person, this much more violent. But this systemically, we deal with them probably the most permissively, at least in some people's minds. Your thoughts about how in the salesmanship of effectiveness and in early interdiction, your thoughts?
Addiction doesn't seem to know an age. When I was dealing in my drug court program, I had people in there whose first time they used was they were 9 years old. And it seemed to be the norm were people who were using when they were 9, 10, 11 years old. So we might get somebody who's 22 or 23 years old who was a 10-year addict. And so, but I also had folks who didn't start till they were in college, and they smoked dope in college, and they started drinking, and then they got into cocaine, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very difficult, if not impossible, to make a distinction with age as far as who's coming into the program. It can be very different, though, in treating them, because if someone starts using drugs, if you look at the science, if I start using drugs seriously when I'm young, and my brain's still developing, my brain stops developing. It starts arresting the development of your brain. So if you talk to somebody who's a treatment professional and treating people, or even people that are just working in these programs, sometimes they're working with people who are 26, 27 years old, who developmentally are like 15 or 16, because they haven't, for example, we all learn to cope with stress in our lives in one way or another, you know, whether you bite your fingernails or however. People who grew up in certain environments and started coping with stress by drinking alcohol when they're 9 years old, they're 26 years old. One thing you have to do in treatment is actually teach them how to deal with stress, because what their coping mechanism for the last 14 years has been the bottle. And so it can be very different in treating them. I guess I never even thought about this as far as like selling it to the public as far as age differences, because what a big piece of drug court says is just accountability, no matter what your age is. Whether it's a juvenile drug court, because there are drug courts that deal with young people or adults, accountability is one of the biggest pieces. That's the sanctions and incentives piece. That's coming in front of the judge. That's what Helen talked about, monitoring, having to knock on the door and get a drug test any time of day. It's that constant accountability. I found that's what sold law enforcement, because law enforcement loved the idea that there's a constant accountability involved, and it's not that someone's going to violate probation and come up in front of a judge in 3 or 4 months on a violation hearing. They're in front of the judge in 24 hours, whether they're 20 years old or 40 years old. So across the board, the selling is this is an accountability piece. And that's what I found. So I decided I don't have the experience in trying the different populations, unless it was a juvenile drug court, and then juvenile issues are we had a juvenile program for 12, 13, 14, and 15 years old, and that was a different issue altogether.
I have done that. Okay. And juveniles are not little adults. And they are a lot.
Now, why don't you come up and sit here, please? We have it on the record. The two of you can sit together.
I like your badge, Helen. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Juveniles are not little adults. And their brain development is unique. And I can tell you, as the mother of 20-year-old twins, I have just gone through this glorious experience. One boy, one girl. And I mention that to you because at 16, my daughter, who was 2 entire minutes older than my son, was much more mature. The brain develops from the back to the front. It continues to develop in males until age 25. It is not stable or steady yet. And so what happens is, when we're treating this population, we must change how we do things. Because while we do rage at our children, and I rage at mine periodically, I have learned to do the following things. I tell my daughter, Cullen, I need you to do A, B, C, D. What do I need you to do? Well, A, B, C, D, mother. Do that. And then I tell my son, Brian, I need you to do A, B, C, D. What do I need you to do? A. And then the twin in a minute will go, oh, A, B, C, D. Come on, Brian. Okay, it's not malicious. He doesn't think correctly yet. So with Brian, I say, Brian, I need you to do A and come back to me. Fabulous work. Now, let's do B. I need you to do B and come back to me. Fabulous work. I need you to do C and come back to me. Right? That is how you deal with an adolescent criminal or drug addict as well. They do not have the capability of handling compound, complex tasks. Further, when you deal with them, because the first part of their brain that actually develops, and I'll tell you who knows this better than us, the game manufacturers. The first part of their brain that develops and comes online strongly is their visual part. And so everything that we do with them in terms of intervention, explaining, and directions is visual. That's how they learn. All of you who sat and talked to teenagers for an extended period of time knows that you're saying something meaningful and the teenager's hearing fa-fa, 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 fa-fa. So when we're talking to them or treating them, it has to be in short bursts, highly visual, very focused, and then come back and do it again later. They can't hear you. They can't pay attention. They don't think like adults. They may be big enough. They may look like adults. They may be big enough to kill you, but they don't have the judgment not to yet. And so everything you do with them has to be different, and how you define success with them is different because you are literally shooting a moving target.
Thank you.
Very different.
I raised four of them. That's where I got the gray hair.
Yeah, uh-huh. Uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh.
The, go ahead, Charlie.
Yeah. That was almost my last question, but you just brought to mind my final question. It has to do with fetal syndromes, fetal alcohol. My assumption is that there will be an echo throughout that young person's life. You will see them, but do you have any information to shed on, let's just take fetal alcohol as an example, whether there's a predominance of those young people showing up in your jurisdiction, or is there any correlation, or is it just something that happened in the background that will never echo through our society later on?
But there's a huge correlation. Huge. Same thing with children born inside homes with methamphetamine. Some of that is an actual development issue, and some of it's treatable and some of it's not. There's a great resiliency factor in young people if you can get into them and start working with them and rechanneling around some of the injuries and restructure them. That's the upside of having such an active growing brain. They learn so much better, so much faster. They improve so well compared to, frankly, us. I mean, a new concept for me, and it takes me like, I'm going to get around to it soon. But they really, you can work with them. If they do not have intervention, and the guy to really talk to about this is a man named Dr. Alex Stalcup, S-T-A-L-C-U-P. He is an addiction treatment expert, and he is a pediatrician. And he is an extraordinary resource for this country. He has amazing information, but he will tell you that if you do not intervene with these young people, that they will become your next group, and they will continue to reverberate through your systems, plural. And so the early intervention work needs to be the minute we assess and detect FAS or failure to thrive or attachment disorders caused by drug abuse inside the home. Those things can be addressed, not sometimes 100%, but they can be addressed. If you do not address them, you buy what criminal justice will be doing in the next 10 years, because they will start to hit the radar, and then they will progress, bump up into juvenile, and then they will bump up into young adults, and then they will bump into your prison. It's sort of a coarse example, but it's a whole lot like watching a gopher go through a snake. You could just see it go.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate you guys being here. We know that 85% of our prisoners in Alaska are what we would call indigent drunks.
Mm-hmm.
We arrest them, we prosecute them, we defend them, we imprison them.
Mm-hmm.
We put their families on welfare.
Mm-hmm.
Very expensive process. Just in my own small company, we have a mandatory screening process, and it's interesting to see. If we catch someone with drugs or alcohol, we allow them to go into a treatment program, give them a chance to come back one time, and those that have gone through that have been able to whip the problem, and two of them come and see me once a year and say, it's my birthday, thank you for catching me. And others have said, it's such a part of my lifestyle, I don't want to change.
Mm-hmm.
And they go somewhere else. I suppose part of this is trying to really find that person who in maybe down there does want to change. and get rid of this monkey on their back. What's your experience there?
Well, that's an interesting one. You effectively coerced some people into treatment, mm-hmm. because the issue was, if you would like to stay here, love you, but you're going to have to go through treatment. The ones who are higher end will decline your kind invitation. They will start treatment, but they will not complete. They'll say, this is too hard for me. There is a myth that you have to wait until people bottom out before they're ready for treatment. Trust me, that's a myth. Drug courts can get a PhD in bottoming people out in about 20 seconds. And we focus them on their problem really quickly. And if they start to get distracted from their problem, which is the nature of addiction, we refocus them again. And so we get people ready to address what's on their back by keeping our eye on their back.
Okay.
Yeah, one thing, Mr. Chairman, that we talked about, Helen mentioned several times, drug courts are based on science and research. The piece that Helen just mentioned about coercion works and treatment, there was actually a study that took 33 years that followed thousands of addicts through every level of care, started in 1968. There were several conclusions from this study, but there are two that are amazingly, they point towards the drug court model. And one of those conclusions was that the longer you can keep somebody in treatment, the better they do. And this study basically said that less than 90 days was having virtually no impact at all. They could say no impact less than 90 days. The longer you could keep them in, the better. A year was optimum for most of these folks, at least a year in treatment. The people who stayed in treatment the longest, in other words, people who did the best, were people who were coerced. Just like you've coerced your employees and said, you've got this chance to do this, just like we coerced them in the justice system, it was people who were coerced. And it's amazing because just like Helen said, for years we've heard people tell us, oh, you can't force someone to treatment. You can't coerce them. They have to come to us. This study says absolutely not.
Well, interestingly, it is the high-end person that I generally hear, well, this program just isn't right for me, mm-hmm. and I have to move on.
We have the other program for them.
Yeah.
We have the door A and door B choice, and it's amazing how when you keep pointing those doors out, they will decide that other program. Maybe they should look at that again.
Yeah. Yeah. Other questions for our guests here this morning? We want to thank you. We do. I think you probably have gotten the impression that our legislature is indeed trying to find ways to address this very significant problem in our society. Now, one of the things that I've found out, I've been in the automobile business for 36 years, and if I'm going to change your tire and I go into my toolbox and get a tool that doesn't get the lug nuts off your wheel, it doesn't help me to get a bigger one. I have to find one that works. And so I hope that as we continue to look for the tools that work for the benefit of our society up here, that we can make significant progress. And I think you've been very helpful in being here today.
Thank you.
Other questions, comments? Thank you very much. Janet, did you have anyone else that you?
I wanted to recognize Robin Johnson, who's the therapeutic court coordinator.
Come on up, Robin, and introduce yourself to us.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, meeting members. For the record, my name is Robin Johnson, R-O-B-Y-N, Johnson. I work for the Alaska Court System, and my position title is Therapeutic Courts Program Coordinator. And in that capacity, I'm responsible for coordinating the therapeutic court program statewide.
Good to have you with us this morning. Are there any questions or any comments? Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, it might be of interest for the committee if Johnson can give us just a very brief overview of what's going on in our therapeutic court system in Alaska and where we're headed.
Well, overall, we have three different kinds of courts in a few different locations. Let me start with the mental health courts first. A lot of the focus has been on the addiction courts, and certainly that's the majority. I will say, though, that in some ways, like Helen talked about door A and B, to a large extent it's the door through which they go. The mental health courts, the first one we had was in Anchorage. And that was actually Judge Stephanie Rhodes. This was one of the first four in the whole country. That went very well. There was a second one established in Palmer. It opened the middle of last year. It was based on the Anchorage model, and that also is going very, very well. In terms of the addiction courts, the first two that were opened were under House Bill 179. That was the felony DUI court in Anchorage and the Bethel court. So they were the first two. Target populations were for alcoholic offenders. And then, of course, Judge Wanamaker with the wellness court for misdemeanor offenders in Anchorage. That court is now expanded. It was originally for municipal offenders, and now it also includes state offenders. In the last 2 years, we've been very fortunate to get some National Transportation Highway Safety money through the Alaska Office of Highway Safety in the Department of Transportation, and that's funded programs in Ketchikan and Juneau. They both opened last year, and they're still ramping up, but they're both going very well. And then, of course, we have Fairbanks that we're still working with. I'm pleased to be able to report in Fairbanks. We hired a project manager in the middle of January, and she's busy working on planning the court up there and with the key stakeholders. And also in Anchorage, we have a family care court. That is the only non-criminal court, and that is for families who are at risk of losing their parental rights. Again, all addiction is...
Representative Roachberg, go ahead.
Do we still have the drug court, Anchorage?
There is still the drug court, yes, thank you. There's the felony drug court. In Anchorage, there's a felony drug and felony DUI court, as well as the wellness courts for criminal offenders.
Other questions for Robin? Go ahead, Representative Roachberg.
Oh, just a point, Mr. Chairman. We requested about... some $900,000 from new highway transportation safety funds as a result of the seatbelt bill, and we've got preliminary approvals on that, so I'm real happy to report that. So far, knock on wood.
All right. Appreciate knowing that. Well, I tell you, this has been very informative this morning, and I have really enjoyed the exchange and a tremendous amount of information, and you know, we were thinking maybe we might get to 222 today. You'll have to apologize to the sponsors, but we'll pick that up. But what is on our calendar for tomorrow, Mr. Poole? We had 206, 306. We'll start with 222 on tomorrow, and then we'll continue on and see where we can get with 206 and 306. So if there's nothing else to come before the committees today, I will adjourn both the House and the Senate Joint Committee, Judiciary Committees.